Live from the Serial Center at Hillsdale College, this is Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM election night coverage.
Quarter past the hour, and we're back. I'm Josh Barker, and thank you for tuning in to Radio Free Hillsdale Live election night coverage. I'm joined this segment by three more great students. I have Thomas McKenna, freshman studying political economy at Hillsdale College, writer for The Collegian. Connor Bolanos, a senior Winston Churchill fellow at Hillsdale College and host of Defense Now, as well as History Shouldn't Be a Mystery on Radio Free Hillsdale. And Tully Mitchell, freshman studying classics from Alabama. Thank you all for joining us tonight. Thomas, I want to start with you. You're from Northern Virginia, and you have your ear on some of the House races there. Districts 2 and 7 both are certainly being looked at. These are seats that, especially in recent elections, have been leaning blue, if not more solidly so. Politico last week, both were marked as toss-ups. District 7 certainly had interesting results last November in the gubernatorial race. So tell us about that. Abigail Spanberger, of course, is currently representing that district. Yesley Vega running as a Republican challenger. What's going on there?
Well, everybody's got their eyes on the House races in Virginia this year, especially the Virginia 7th. Political Report House editor Dave Wasserman and Republican analyst Karl Rove said that these are races they're going to be watching. Right now in the Virginia 7th, Yesley Vega, with about 45% of the vote in, she's up 54-45 on Democrat incumbent Abigail Spanberger. But we do want to note that we also see Prince William County just coming in with 28% of their votes in, and Spanberger is leading well there. So Prince William and Stafford County are going to be key for that race as we go forward throughout the night. The other thing to note is that we're also seeing high turnout in rural counties in that district. And rural counties historically have tended to vote more Republican. So that's something that Vega is certainly looking at tonight.
Yeah, and so for our listeners, the geography there, obviously District 7 borders on the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., close to the outskirts, Prince William County. That's the closest county to the district in District 7, right, to D.C.?
That's right. And the Virginia 7th has a good mix of the demographics we'll see throughout the country, including, you know, suburban women as well as voters in the rural areas of the county.
Connor, you're from Illinois. And let's just say, I mean, even we were mentioning last segment, New York has some people curious, will there be an upset? I don't think anyone's wondering, will Illinois flip to Republicans? Why should we care about Illinois? What races are going on there that are particularly interesting to you?
So obviously the Senate and the governorship I don't really think are in contest. I'm pretty sure looking at New York Times, they pretty much immediately called the Senate for Tammy Duckworth without any votes in whatsoever. But the races that are more so interesting that are really important to look at are the ballot measures in the Illinois Collective Bargaining Amendment, in addition to the two open seats on the Illinois Supreme Court. Experts say that this is really the first chance the Republicans will have in 50 years in order to win back those two seats on the Supreme Court. In the second and third Supreme Court districts, where in the second district you have Democrat Elizabeth Rockford against the Republican Mark Curran, and in the third district you have the incumbent justice who was redistricted into the third Supreme Court district, Mike Burke, against Democrat Mary O'Brien. I think it's going to be a bit of an uphill, though, battle for the Republicans in this front, especially since issues such as abortion do rank high on the list of things in Supreme Court and kind of judicial races, in contrast to the other races where we've kind of seen the economy coming out as the number one issue. And I think in a state like Illinois, which has a kind of partisan, you could say, Supreme Court election system, you know, they run as Republicans or Democrats, I think the combination of the down ballot effect and the fact of abortion and gun rights being those primary issues are probably going to make it a bit of an uphill battle for Republicans. But luckily for them, the second district and the third district are more kind of suburban white-collar districts and a little bit of a combination of some rural districts outside of the immediate influence of Cook County. So there's certainly a chance for a little bit of pickup there.
Now, briefly, could you talk about how exactly those, for our listeners who aren't from Illinois, how those Supreme Court elections work? Here in Michigan, of course, we have Supreme Court justices on the ballot, but they run nonpartisan, which you alluded that your justices actually do run partisan, and it's a statewide thing. It's based on, you know, a certain number of years they run for terms. How are these candidates running? Is it by a geographic district, or what's at play there?
Yeah, so Illinois is divided into a number of Supreme Court districts, each of them having one judge, with the exception of the first district, which encompasses a majority of Cook County, which has three judges for it. So the two races we'll have are in the second and third. They run as either Democrats or Republicans, and the voters within those districts will vote for their particular judge. And so that's kind of been something that's come up. I've been reading about a number of voters who thought that they were going to be voting on these Supreme Court judges in the other districts, only to learn that they ultimately weren't.
The right to bodily autonomy in Prop 3. Avery, tell us, right before we go to break, what is your take on Prop 3? What exactly would it do?
Yeah, my take on Prop 3 is that it's a codification of Casey. It's a determinant by fetal viability, which is determined by doctors, not by state legislature members, which I think is extremely important. We don't need the state legislature dictating these important rights that are determined by women and doctors. I don't think that the characterization that this does anything to parental consent laws is accurate. Legal scholars at the University of Michigan Law School have argued that the state constitution already protects parental consent under different guidelines in the state constitution, and minor laws are always different than laws that go to the rest of the state. And so I don't think it's a fair characterization to say that this is going to enshrine pedophilia into the Michigan state constitution.
All right, well, we'll have all these people back to talk about Prop 3 and abortion more here in the state of Michigan. It's 5 till 9. The next hour is jam-packed with some amazing guests. Right after the break, Associate Professor of Politics Dr. Joseph Postel will be joining me, along with Luke Spangler and Josh Hypes. Polls closing in another 14 states at the top of the hour. I'm Josh Barker, and you're listening to Live Election Night coverage on Radio Free Hillsdale 101.7 FM.
Nevada is a purple state and has been considered one of the battleground states the past several election cycles. Once again, it is in the public eye, as Republicans might flip its Senate seat, gaining control of the Senate. The race is between incumbent Senator Catherine Cortez Matzo and Republican and former State Attorney General Adam Laxalt. Last time she was on the ballot in 2016, Senator Cortez Matzo won by 3 points. Laxalt was last on the ballot in 2018 running for governor and lost by 4 points. However, unlike 2018, this year is a fairly unfavorable environment for Democrats. Real Clear Politics average has Laxalt ahead by 1 point, and every major polling outlet rates this race as a toss-up. We'll see what happens.
Polls are just now closing in 14 states across the nation, including in some of the most hotly contested races in the country. Arizona and Wisconsin have the control of the Senate hanging in the balance, potentially. Our highlight guest is Dr. Joseph Postel. He's an associate professor of politics at Hillsdale College, received his PhD from the University of Dallas, author of Bureaucracy in America, the Administrative State's Challenge to Constitutional Government, and the editor or co-editor of about half a dozen other books. Dr. Postel, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you tonight.
So it's still early out there in the evening. It is 9 p.m. here on the East Coast. 2016 to 2018, 2020 seems like just a bunch of craziness. Florida and North Carolina now more solidly red, Pennsylvania, Arizona, even Georgia being considered toss-up states. I don't think anyone would have really imagined, especially Georgia back in 2016. The fact that there's a radical change taking place in electoral politics is pretty clear. What exactly that change entails is altogether different. Talk to us about making sense of these general trends and how they're affecting us. Are we living through a new party alignment, as some people are suggesting, or is this just a shift of support among certain demographic groups?
Yeah, I think it's a lot more of the latter. So I like to show my students, when we look at realignments in American history, what a real realignment looks like. So I showed them the electoral maps for the presidential elections of 1964, where Lyndon Johnson beat Barry Goldwater. Goldwater carries 6 states. Lyndon Baines Johnson wins 44. And then in 1972, Richard Nixon wins 49 out of 50 states. So you look at a map, 8 years, right, you see blue completely switch to red. And so that's what realignments look like historically in American politics. This is a little bit more of like a granular shift among certain demographic groups, like you said. So clearly this matters, right? This puts some states in play for a party that hasn't been able to compete, you know, Michigan, Wisconsin, maybe Pennsylvania for Republicans, Georgia, Arizona, right, for Democrats. But I think this is more of sort of subtle shifts within the electorate rather than these major realignments that we have seen earlier in American history.
Radio Free Hillsdale, 101.7 FM, live election night coverage. I'm Josh Barker, and this is Dr. Joseph Bostel, as well as Josh Hype's Luke Spangler. Michigan governor's race, we've got 9% of the vote in, so it's still very slowly but steadily coming. Gretchen Whitmer at 52.8%, Tudor Dixon down 45%. So this is certainly a wide gap, but only 9% of the vote in. Interestingly, going through our ballot propositions, Proposition 3, which we just spoke briefly about, we'll talk more about in the next hour, the right to reproductive freedom, currently, again, 8% of the vote in. 58% yes, 42% no. That means that Prop 3 is definitely outperforming Governor Whitmer, which is not necessarily surprising based on the polling, but definitely interesting to note. As far as the governor's race in Florida goes, Trump won Florida by about 3 points in 2020. DeSantis leads by 19, 86% in. That's a significant performance. We have joining us by phone James David Dixon. He's the managing editor of the Michigan Capital Confidential out of the Mackinac Center for Public Policy. Mr. Dixon, thank you for joining us this evening.
Hey, guys, thank you so much for having me.
What role do you see the governor's COVID policies as playing both in the voters' decisions tonight and potentially the policy implications if she is indeed reelected, even if COVID doesn't resurge?
Well, I think if Whitmer were to be reelected, it would in some ways be an affirmation of what she did. The reason why she might lose, though, is because normally, you know, the traditional role for the media is to play a watchdog role over someone like a governor. So if you have a governor who says something like, hey, all 10 million people should stay home for this small list we made in my office, normally you'd expect some pushback, but that never came. Normally you'd expect investigations into, well, wait a minute, lockdowns were never part of the plan for a pandemic before. How did suddenly we come to this place? Normally you would expect the media to do that. The media hasn't done that. And so that means for most people in Michigan, if you did have a problem with how lockdowns happen, shutdowns, gyms, restaurants, all kinds of things, schools, if you did have a problem with that, today has really been your first chance in 2.5 years to speak up.
Interestingly, in Georgia, New York Times has Walker, Herschel Walker, the Republican candidate, with a 61% chance of winning. Luke Spangler, tell us about what you're looking at. Are there any other interesting results that you're seeing?
So overall, tonight, I think we were fooled by a massively strong swing towards the Republicans in Florida at the beginning of the night. Just watching returns in general, I think we're back to where most people thought we were to the start of the night, where Republicans should make, in the end, enough modest gains in the House to take that body, and the Senate is going to be still in limbo probably for the days and maybe even weeks ahead if Georgia goes to runoff. Just so many tight races, and just not a clear, decisive victory in any major race outside of Florida yet.
Regarding our predictions, what are you predicting for ballot proposals on abortion in Kansas and Michigan?
Well, I think that it's most likely that they're going to pass. And what I mean by that is that there is going to be a codification of the right to an abortion in the law from the voters. And I think what that shows is, as much as the pro-life movement was celebrating the win in Dobbs, it was a shift in the debate, not a winning of the debate. And the shift in the debate was, now you're going to have to make the case to voters, and you're going to start to see that there is a diversity of sort of the abortion debate at the court level at times seem to make things like an all-or-nothing proposition, a completely pro-life or a completely pro-choice position. It seems like a lot of voters are somewhere in the middle, and you're going to have to make that argument to them why the pro-life movement should not only have won in the court, but now needs to win at the ballot box. And the question is, not in any way does that mean they've lost definitively, but how are they going to come back and reconstitute their argument?
All right, this is Radio Free Hillsdale live election night coverage. We'll be talking more about abortion and Prop 3 as well as other things after the break. This has been Dr. Adam Carrington, Haley Strack, Josh Barker. After the break, we'll be back with Avery Noel, Gabriel Powell, and Elizabeth Troutman. We'll see you then.